Ross Gurney Randall, second time lucky, because the first one, the first interview we tried to do for some reason technically died, but maybe this is the one that is meant to happen as we sit on New Road watching the Fringe and much more go by. Ross, was there or is there an air of inevitability in you that in the end you would end up playing Henry VIII?
You've asked me this before. I don't see it. It's quite worrying, actually, because it's fairly clear that everyone else does. And the thing is, Henry VIII wasn't... I don't think much of him. So I find this quite upsetting.
No, but for you, as a man who could have made a lot more money than you've made just doing Henry VIII impersonations, come on.
Really? Do you know what? I've resisted playing him for a long while. Partly because I couldn't grow a beard, but I thought shy of it. It was Pete Howes who I wrote it with. It was his idea. We were drinking beer in the battle, being rude to each other, and he said, "If you ever played Henry VIII, you should do because you're doing him now." And that was the start of it, really. But no, I really don't. I suppose there was something inevitable about it. I'm not keen on the idea, I'll be honest. Because it took me a long while to work out why. I mean, people call him a great king. I don't think he was a great king. He was an important one, significant one, but he wasn't a great king. He was an awful man, I think. So yeah.
I mean, just to park Henry for a moment, something you've been remarkably good at in your career at doing is either agreeing to be in other people's productions, you know, or passing the auditions, or choosing yourself characters from history that you can fully inhabit.
Right.
So Albert Pierpoint, Goering, Mussolini.
You've got to pick people you find interesting. Goering I found interesting from years before we ever thought of doing a show about it. When someone suggested I did a one-man show, I said we should do it about him because I thought he was so contradictory and had so much going on. And also because he was so contradictory, if you made a character up like that, people go, well, that's very interesting, it's not very realistic. But because he actually was that and did do those things, I think he was a really good subject. Mm. And Pierpoint, I just read his biography and I thought, that's not what I expected a hangman to sound like. So I thought, yeah, that's a good one to do. And Mussolini, because if he wasn't real and he hadn't killed people, he would be funny. He'd be intrinsically funny. That's why I wanted to do him. You've got to be interested in them, though. You've got to really want to think about them for a long time.
Say with Pierpoint, you read a biography, and that awakens this impulse to play him. With Mussolini and, say, Goering, was it also film footage? Was, as they strutted and postured, did you imagine yourself able to do it or wanting to do it?
Oh, no, I don't think of them like that at all. I don't look at images and go, I'm going to be like them. It's what they said and what they did that I think that's the thing about Henry VIII. I mean, I know I do look like him a bit, but I don't really... that's not how I think about doing a character.
And I was only tongue-in-cheek mentioning to suggest it away, that I, having seen a lot of your work, you do... You choose characters, you research them, and then you've got this task, haven't you, of actually stepping into their skin with whatever physicality and skills you've got. And then you need... Your challenge is for us to sit there and utterly forget it's Ross Gurney Randall and utterly believe that these iconic characters are in front of us, some of whom, of course, we haven't met. But there are a lot of media images and books about them.
And that is sometimes a problem. I think some people get too wrapped up in trying to look like the character. I mean, I don't think you need to. And I think, for me anyway, I think it's better not to try. You'll get to be like them by understanding them, or making up your mind about them or your view of them.
And how much of, and this may be different for the different characters you play, but how much of the character, you know, is generated by you as not only an actor but also a maker of theatre, and how much of it is drawn out by a director watching you?
Well, that's a very good question. Depends on the director. Some directors have very strong views. If you work with Guy Masterson, and he has very, very strong, very immediate views, and sometimes you have to fight him tooth and nail. Other directors see themselves as, one of them described it as being like a gym buddy, that they help you along the way. But with, especially with the new scripts, most of the directors will surprise you by their they've read it and they go, they point something out, you think, oh, I hadn't thought of that. But then you look at the script and you think, oh, no, that is in there. And that's the brilliant thing about having someone else on board. I know some people don't use directors, but I think you need one. And a good one is especially in a one-person show, it's the only companion you've got, really.
You know? So taking the case study now of the latest character, Henry, so you've given us an overview, but just give us a little bit more detail then about how you've chosen the character, you research the character, then you have to start creating the character, there's a script, it comes to the stage. What's going on specifically?
Well, first of all, we had to work out... there's two of us writing it, and we had to find a way of working together. And that was writing different bits, then getting together in the same room. And thankfully that worked, and Pete House, right, who I've known for years, but we'd never worked together before. It was a complete gamble. But we agreed if it didn't work out, we'd just stop. So there was no pressure on that front. Then we finished the first draft. We had an idea of who we'd like to direct it, and it's Tony Harza, and Tony read the script and went, yeah, I'm up for that. But then he came in and he did a sort of a script edit, you know, for the three of us in the room, and it was quite sharp and ruthless, which was good.
And that was agreed, that's what he would do. You wanted the director to come in and they were allowed to kind of co-write with you.
Yeah. I think yeah, basically. But also all scripts, new ones, get chopped and changed, and actually that happens in the rehearsal period. But for someone to come in and actually point out a lot of the faults and the bits that needed changing before we got there saved a lot of time, because you don't have much time in rehearsal very often. So actually it was a week, and it was quite intense, but it was really useful. It saved a lot of bother. But there was one section which I fought tooth and nail for, argued its cause throughout the whole thing, because it was kind of one of the reasons I'd wanted to do it. Just the first time we staggered through it, you know, just me and the director, and he went, right, what about that bit? And you could see he was rather tentative, and I went, oh, don't worry about it. I'm just hearing it once with the rest of it. I know it doesn't fit in, so it's gone.
So there's a bit of you. I've been interviewing a couple of people today that talked about, at some point, there's a humility that if it's not there, it could screw the show up. You have to let things go, don't you?
Oh, you've got to, yes. You have to just face the fact that, it doesn't work. That bit doesn't work, just let it go. You can't cling on to things that patently don't work, even if they were the bit that originally inspired you to do the piece. It was called The Habsburg's Chin, and I like it as a piece of writing, but there's no way it belonged in the show. So that's that.
And then what about embodying Henry? I mean, I guess once you're in costume, you know, that helps, but without even costume, how do you decide this is how he stands, you know, this is how he moves?
It's not a decision. You just come to things that feel comfortable. With him, I've had a lot of physical sort of pain recently, and sort of back problems and what have you. And so I kind of just use that, really. I naturally limp if I don't wear an orthotic. So he's got a limp, it kind of helps. That kind of thing, really. And you just sort of... you just use little bits of what you've got and just sort of emphasise them or twist them. That's how it works.
But that's why you're not doing David Beckham.
Yeah, that is the inevitability of playing a 56-year-old cripple who's dead.
So whilst respecting, you know, the pain that goes with that, that whole process, if you look back on that, would you describe it as one of enjoyment or one of struggle and suffering?
It's enjoyable, it's interesting. I mean, it can be frustrating. But I would describe it as the main thing is it's not boring. It's interesting. It's fascinating. That's what it should be. That's what it was. Yeah. Sometimes it's hard work. But I do shy away from the idea of struggle and, you know, all that kind of, and lots of German words for sort of, you know, that kind of thing. And you think, nah, it was meant to be a fun show. That doesn't mean to say it's got to be a fun process all the way, but it should have a bit of that in there. And I was working with Tony Harza, he's one of the funniest men I've ever met. And that was good, you know, that was really enjoyable. So, yeah.
And in this piece, the fourth wall is down in places. So when the audience is added, you know, then what happens?
Well, I really, it's cool, yes. But, I mean, the title's really deliberate. It is an audience with him. It's we're all in it together. That has changed. In the first venue we did in Brighton, we were at the Lectern, which is a really nice venue. Very compact, very small. And I was looming over them. And the audience were quite polite because of that. And then we've taken it on tour and been in bigger places, and that's been much more. There's been much more heckling and back and forth, and that's part of the idea. And we're in the Bosco for these, and that was perfect for it. I thought there's a sort of a rowdiness that goes with tents and benches and that kind of thing. That interaction and picking on people and people being able to sort of come back at you. That's kind of what this one was about. I don't particularly care for the fourth wall. I like shows where it's one of the few advantages small scale theatre's got, is that you are in that room together and you are eyeballing each other. So you should make the most of that, I think. That's what I like shows to be like.
And so apart from, you know, the pure entertainment and the spectacle of meeting Henry and the historical interest, in a world where, you know, there's violence outside the latest Trump talk yesterday, and there's a whole kind of dialogue about what is monarchy now and how the royals behave and so on. Do you think that in watching this, it throws light on some of our questions about monarchy today?
Not monarchy today, because he was a monarch in a way that monarchs aren't anymore. But one
or
of the things,
government.
Yeah, it's more about that. It's more about that the kind of the personal side of being in power. It's probably the thing you would take from it, is that the fact that politics is personal. And that the stuff that isn't theoretically important in ruling is because they're just human beings and they have as many faults and weaknesses as we do. And that's probably the thing I would say would translate to now. He says in it, as a king, your faults are magnified, they're pulled out of proportion by office and state. And that, I think, is true. There's lots of us walking around with personal faults that don't matter because we haven't got the power or the clout to sort of twist them and enforce them on other people. And that's a good thing. But he does highlight the fact that the ridiculousness of leaving someone in charge permanently, that's probably what it... Yeah, you could take that from it, certainly.
Final question. You've played a lot of different characters and some, you know, have been in solo shows. And the writer Kurt Vonnegut always, it reminds me of this when I think of him, talked about living along a line of time that, you know, gets bigger as you get older behind you. And you could look along that line and there's all the stuff that you've accrued and all the people you've met, and there's a line ahead of all the stuff you all accrue and so on, a classic sort of line. And you could probably say similar for actors, that there's the characters you've played and now there's Henry. Mm. As you mature and do other stuff, where do you put your characters?
Oh, good question. Some of them last with you longer than others, and because they're still interesting. I still kind of want to know more about some of them, and that's fine. Others just stop. You know, you think, oh, I just did that, and that's...
But do you put them away, or do you think you burn them?
Oh, I don't have any conscious sort of way of, you know, there is no ceremony. Some people do that, I know. They kind of have to consciously. You just get interested in new things, and the brain doesn't hold too much. So you're interested in new people, new things, and new characters maybe, and they generally get shunted back and out of the arse, you know.
Nice word to finish on there for an interview. I'm going to give you an opportunity just as we finish to offer, and I know you're not a PR sort of guy anyway, but to invite people to come and have an audience with Henry.
Well, that's very kind of you, but we haven't got any gigs booked at the moment.
But imagine you do. Because that'll describe the show a little bit, and it's nice to finish on that. Come and see Henry.
Come and see Henry when I book another venue to put him in. How's that? That's a real hard sell, isn't it? Yeah. Sorry.
A humble man. No.
An unprepared man.
That's good. Well, hopefully some dates coming soon, but that's been a really fascinating insight into your world of theatre making. Thanks, Ross Gurney-Randall.
Cheers.